We're holding your Dalet Ahmed Bey's, the 8 lines from the bottom. Continuing with the Mishnah on the various things that need dayanim and how many of them they need. The Mishnah had said hekdesh, that a hekdesh requires three. So what we mean is pidyon. So we mean redeeming hekdesh. So Rashi gives an example. Let's say somebody had donated a behemoth tmeya to Hekdesh. That animal now it belongs to Hekdesh. If he wants to redeem it to be able to use it, then we're saying we need three people to evaluate it. So the Gemara
And
says,
you repeat that.
we're saying that that Hekdesh, and the Mishnah had said, requires three people to evaluate it in order to buy it back from Hekdesh.
Which does
Your Dalet Ahmed Bey is 8 lines from the bottom.
Okay.
So Hekdesh is Bishloisha. So the Gemara points out Masnissin Deloiki Haitana. Our Mishnah, which is saying that three is enough for that purpose, is not like the following Tana. The Tanya, Rebbe Elazar ben Yaakov Omer, Afilut Tsinoda Shel Hekdesh. And even if you have a tiny little tsinoda of hekdesh, and we'll explain in a second what a tsinoda is, you need 10 people to evaluate it in order to buy it back from hekdesh. Rashi defines tsinoda as a little fork that's used for spinning gold threads. Tosfos discusses that there are a few other possibilities of what Sinoda is. We also find that Sinoda is also used of various other small tools. It also, for example, it means the hook of an earring. It also means a little thing, or a little pointy thing or whatever for cleaning out wicks and oils like from the menorah. So there are several different implements called tzinodah. So basically, in other words, a tzinodah is a little sharp instrument of one of various kinds. Anyway, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov is saying that even if you have that, even so, it's a tiny little thing. You need 10 people to be involved in being poydet. Omelet a papa abaya. So a papa asks abaya why. So fuck it. Why in our Mishnah do you need three? B'shleimel Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov. I can understand according to Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, he would say, why does he say you need 10 for anything of Hekdesh? Kishmuel, Da'oma Kishmuel. He would say, like what Shmuel says later on, Da'oma Shmuel, Asara Koinim Ksuvim B'parasha. When it talks about in Parashas Bechukosai, when it talks about a person had donated land to the Beis Hamikdash, and then he wants to buy it back. So the pasuk says 10 times in those psukim, it says the word kohen. So to be exact, it actually breaks it down. You have first it talks about parashas erchin. First it talks about the case where a person declared that I'm going to pledge my erech or somebody else's erech to the Beis Hamikdash, and 3 times in that connection it mentions the word kohen. If he has enough money to pay the erech, you don't need a kohen, just give it to the kohen, and that's that. But if he doesn't have enough money to pay the erech, then a kohen has to evaluate his financial capabilities and decide how much he can give, how much he has to give hekdesh. So 3 times it says kohen there. Another 3 times it says when it comes to hekdesh. Another 3 times. When it comes to an animal that a person donated to Hekdesh, and we don't mean an animal for a korban, we mean an animal that can't be used for a korban. It's a baal mum, or it's an actual behemoth tmei or whatever. And then 4 times it says when it comes to karka, where a person donates land to Hekdesh and wants to buy it back. So altogether 10 times. So Shmuel points out that 10 times in the parasha. Overall, it says the word koyin, and therefore Shmuel learned says it's based on that we said in the Mishnah that you need 10 people when it comes to evaluating the value of karka that a person had donated to Hekdesh. He wants to buy it back from Hekdesh, so you need altogether 10 because of those 10 times koyin that it says in the parasha. But where are the Chachamim getting that three is enough, as it said in our Mishnah? Well, then you're going to say, well, very simple, because again, let's break it down. And we're saying that you have three by Erchin, three by Behemoth Tmeya, and four by Karka. So you're going to say, okay, it's just three by Behemoth Tmeya, and therefore you need six, and therefore you need three only. The question is, Kakoris Tichtibu Abba Tiski Baba. Well, then the question is, when Karka, when it says that that you have that all, of the 10 times Koyan, only four of them does it say in connection with Karka. So it should be enough to do four. And yet the Mishnah had said, nami, and you're going to say, okay, yeah, so four is enough for Karka. No, Aloma Tanan, then why do we learn in the Mishnah, Hakakor is Tishiva Koyan, that Karka requires nine Yisraelim plus one Koyan. So we see that, in other words, when it comes to Karka, we're taking all the words Koyan throughout those three sections and we're combining them together to arrive at a number of 10. So Elamite Mashli Bahu Asara. So then you're gonna say, okay, maybe what it is in other words, it's cumulative. You're adding together. So by Erchin you need three, let's say you would say. And then when it comes to Karka, since it's mentioned last, then you have all three groups. You're saying that all of them are tied together. To Tilmud Tachtonim El Yonah, Rashi says you would learn the later one from the earlier one. So you would say you need three plus three plus four, and that's why you need 10 by Karka. Well, Hekdeshus Demashlim Behushita. Well, then, by that logic, why don't we say by Hekdesh that you have six so far? Because you have six, you have three for Erchin and three for Behemoth Meah. So you should say, therefore, that when it comes to that when it comes to Metaltlin of Hekdesh, you should require six to evaluate them by that logic. So the Behushita, so you should require six. Because that's the second one of these three sections over there. So the one says Kasha, you're right, it's a Kasha, how the Chachamim are saying that you're getting three given all of the above. On the face of it, either they should be saying 10, like Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, meaning that we're taking the 10 that apply, that we're taking the 10 that you have in that entire, in across those three parashiyos and applying it across the board, or you should say that, or you should say with each section, it's going to be cumulative, however many you have so far, so therefore, yeah, on the face of it, by Erchin, you should need three. By Hekdish of Metaltlin, you should need six. And Hekdish of Karka, you should need 10. So where are they getting three? When it comes to Hekdish of Metaltlin, the Gemara says Kasha, it's a Kasha. Nevertheless, you know, as usual, Kasha is not a Tiyufta. It doesn't mean we've slugged up what the Chachamim are saying. The fact is, the Halacha is, like the Chachamim, that you only need three when it comes to Metaltlin of Hekdish. 10 you need only when it comes to Karka. Next, the Mishnah said Erchin Chula. The Mishnah said that Erchin, the Erchin Hamataltlin. The Mishnah said Erchin that are Metaltlin require three. So what does that mean? Erchin, an Erech means when a person says, "I pledge my Erech or the Erech of Pliny to the Bais Mikdash." An erech applies only to a person. There's no such thing as an erech for a keli or anything like that. So the Mishnah had said her erechin hamataltlin chola. So my erechin hamataltlin. So what do we mean by erechin hamataltlin? What does that phrase mean? Omer of Gidol Omer Rav. So we're gonna have a few different answers. So Omer of Gidol Omer Rav, but erech kli ze olai. It means where the person says that I pledge to give the erech of this keli to the Bais Mikdash. Now, what does that mean? A keli doesn't have an erech. An erech refers to a person. So, the Omer of Gidol Omer Rav, as we also find Rav Gidol himself saying in the name of Rav, Ha'oimer erech kli ze olai, when a person says, I pledge the erech of this keli, and I pledge to give it to the Bais Mikdash, noisin domov, then instead we say, so obviously the keli itself doesn't have an erech, but what we mean is, in other words, then he would have to pay the value of that keli to the Bais Mikdash. Now, when it comes to hekdish, we draw a distinction between erech and domim. With a person, you can have both. A person can have that, A person has an erech, namely if a person says I pledge my erech or somebody else's erech, then we look up in Parshas Bechukosai in the first section that we just talked about a minute ago. You look over there based on the person's age, based on male or female, and you have a certain fixed amount that you're paying hekdesh, unless he can't afford it, and then he pays less, as we're going to talk about soon. And then you have domim. Now that doesn't depend on the person's physical, on the person's physical strength or capabilities or anything like that. It's just a fixed value based on age and gender. Then you have domim, which is where a person says domai olai or dmei pliny olai or whatever. And there we actually uh, there There we look at how much they're actually worth, suppose they were to be sold as a slave or a maidservant, and we calculate accordingly. So by a person you have both erech and domim. By a keli, there's no such thing as erech. There's no such thing as erech. So Rav Gidol is saying that instead you give domim. My time, Odom Yadesh, ain't Erech Lakli, because a person knows there's no such thing as an Erech for a Keli. By definition, a Keli not having a Neshama has only Dhamim. The Gum of Omel, Shum Dhamim, and therefore he decides that what he's doing is he used the word Erech, but nevertheless he meant to say Dhamim, because as we say, Ein Odom Motzi Dvarav L'Vatala, a person doesn't just speak meaninglessly. So if he's saying something, we assume that he, if he said it, we assume that he wants to make something of it, namely that he wants it to be dummim. Tosfos points out that in other places in Shas, the Gemara explains that specifically Reb Meir holds that way. Okay. So that's one. So that's one. That's the first explanation of our Mishnah. So therefore, Mishum Hachi Noisin Damav. So therefore, that's why he gives the Damim. So in other words, when the Mishnah says Har Erchin HaMetaltlin means Erchin of Metaltlin. So in other words, he decided that he's going to give an Erech of Metaltlin, and instead we're saying he's paying a certain amount. So now, when we have to figure out how much the Keli is worth, then we need three people to evaluate it. The question is, hi erchin ha-metaltlin, then why is the Mishnah using the word erchin that are metaltlin, erchin shel metaltlin riboyle? Then in that case, it should say erchin of metaltlin, which is what we're talking about. Okay, so the Gemara says, Tani, erchin shel metaltlin, fine. So read the Mishnah that way. Understand that the words erchin ha-metaltlin in the Mishnah means erchin shel metaltlin. That's one way of explaining. That's a way of explaining the Mishnah. And yeah, it doesn't. The wording is a little bit off, but that's not a big deal. Okay, that's the first answer. Rav Chista Omer Avimi. Rav Chista says in the name of Avimi, another answer. What we mean is where a person says, a person did pledge his own Erech or somebody else's Erech, but then he pledges that he's going to take these Metaltlin and use them to pay off his Erech. So in other words, let's say, so he's a man between 20 and 60 years old. We look up in Parashas in B'chol Kosai, and we find that he owes 50 shkolim to the Beis Hamikdash. So he takes a keli, which is worth 50 shkolim, or which he perceives to be worth 50 shkolim, and he says that I'm going to give this to the Beis Hamikdash to pay off my erech. So now we need three people to actually evaluate it and see whether indeed it is worth 50. Well, the question is, hi erchin hamataltlin. Again, that doesn't really fit with the wording of the Mishnah, which says erchin hamataltlin, metaltlin shall erchin mi boile. Then it should say the other way around, metaltlin of erchin. Because in other words, you have the erch comes first, and then you have the metaltlin is being used for the purpose of erchin. Okay, so the Gemara says also, again, not such a problem. Tony metaltlin shall erchin. Fine, you can reinterpret the words of the Mishnah that way, that it means metaltlin that are going to be used to pay off that are going to be used to pay off erchin. Okay. Then a third answer. Rabbi Bahu Omar. Ba'omer erki alai. Again, we are talking about Rabbi Bahu says that he says I pledge my erech, but the difference is unlike in Rav Chista's answer, where then he's saying that. I'm going that I myself am going to take this particular metaltlin and use it to pay off that erech. We're talking about that he doesn't pay it himself, and the kohen comes to take a mashkin from him until he pays up. So he comes to take from him and finds that he has metaltlin. So so he says I pledge my erech, but he hasn't yet designated any particular metaltlin to pay it off. So now when the Kohen comes and finds Metaltlin, then we need three people to evaluate the value of that Metaltlin. So Bo Kohen, Ligus Men and Metaltlin, if the Kohen now comes to take Metaltlin from him Beshloisha, then it's enough to have three people evaluate it. Kaukois, but if he wants to take Kauka from him Basora, then you need 10, because as usual, with Kauka, you always need 10. So that's a third explanation. So that's the third explanation of what it means. So now that does fit with the words of the Mishnah, Metaltlin, Erchin Hametaltlin, namely Erchin that are being paid off with Metaltlin. So that's the third explanation of the Mishnah. The Rashash actually has a lot of difficulty with that in that case. Then why mention specifically Erchin? Then the same thing would apply. The same thing would apply to Damim. And he goes and discusses at some length that in the first two answers at least you have a Chiddush in the Mishnah, but according to the third answer, what exactly is the Chiddush? So he says, and he discusses some points of it. So he says maybe actually the Mishnah really means to say two things: ha'erchin, where a person has pledged an erech and now he can't afford it, so then we have to figure out how much his net worth is so that he can pay it off. So then we would need three people for that. V'amataltlin, and then you would be with a rich person. We're saying over here he can afford it, but he hasn't yet given it, and therefore the kohenim are coming to take from him something, and the question is how much they need to take from him. So omaleir of achmi difti l'ravina. So Rav Acham Edifti asks Ravina, then why do we need three people for that? B'shlemela apukim a hekdesh, but in and shloisha. I understand to take something out of hekdesh. When you have something which is hekdesh, and now you want to and now you want to be poided from hekdesh, then I understand you need three people to evaluate it, because you don't want a person to undervalue it. So when you have three people figuring it out, then it'll come out to be a fair value. But here it's the other way around. In Reb Abohu's case, he pledged an erech, and now we're going to take metaltlin of his and use that to pay off the erech. So it's bringing it into hekdesh. Shlosh alamali. Why do we need three people to be involved? Why do we need three people to be involved in evaluating the value of it? So Ravina says, look, it's a svara. Mali ayuli, mali apuki. What's the difference between bringing something into hekdesh or bringing it out? Meaning, in other words, either way, you're involved with taking something. You're involved with taking something that has a financial value, that has a monetary value, and involved with hekdesh. So therefore, so you need the same number of people for both. Apuki my timer. After all, why do you need three people when it comes to taking it out of hekdesh? The reason is dilmatoi, because he might make a mistake and he might undervalue it, and therefore you need therefore you need people to be making sure that he's valuing it fairly. Well, then when it comes to bringing it in, then also it may be that somebody will make a mistake and undervalue it, and therefore you need and therefore you need Therefore, you need somebody to value. To, therefore, you need somebody. Therefore, you need three people to make sure that it has the correct value, that it will, in fact, pay off this erech that he said. Okay. So that's the final explanation about the other ones. The fact is, I mean, the other explanations are also valid as well. That in the other cases also you may need three people to evaluate them as well. Next, Rabbi Yehuda had said that when it comes to karka, then you need nine Yisraelim plus a kohen. In the Mishnah, Rabbi Yehuda had said that yes, you need only three when it comes to metal, when it comes to evaluating metalplin, but one of those three, Rabbi Yehuda said, has to be a kohen. I understand according to Rabbi Yehuda. The fact is, when it talks about this business of evaluating the value of something of hektish and giving hektish the appropriate amount, then it uses the word koyin over and over in the parasha, and therefore you would say that therefore according to him that's why you need a koyin. But of Elul Rabbanan, Koyin Lamalahu, according to the Chachamim, why did it say the word koyin in the first place? If according to the Chachamim, it's fine to have all Yisraelim do this. And the Gemara says Kasha. It's a Kasha why the Chachamim would say that it's fine to have Yisraelim do it rather than requiring exclusively Koyanim, but nevertheless, or at least one Koyan. But again, nevertheless, that's how it is. The Gemara goes on. A Kois Tishav a Koyan. We said when it comes to Karka, you need nine Yisraelim plus one Koyan. So Menahani Mili. So where do we know that from, that you need that number? Because like we said before, 10 times in the parasha, it says the word koyin. One is needed Legufe, just to tell us that you need a kayin. Hana having miut acha miut. When it comes to the other nine, what it is a miut acha miut. The fact that it's saying over and over koyin 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 means, in other words, so we're saying each time you're excluding anybody else. And we have a rule in Torah that when you have a miut acha miut, when you have an exclusion after another exclusion, then actually what you're being is on the contrary, you're being marbe. You're including that you could include something that otherwise wouldn't have been included. So da fil of test Yisrael ve'echad koyin. So even you have nine Yisraelim and one koyin, then it's valid. Maskeflor of Huna Breder of Nosin. What Rav Huna Breder of Nosin asks on that, Eim chamisha koyin v'chamisha Yisraelim. Well, fine, but how do you know that it means that you that that? How do we know that it means nine Yisraelim and one Kohen, that you're going to take the miut, you're going to take the miut, acha miut, that far. And Rashi explains, in other words, the idea would be, we would say the first one is Deir Legufoi, the second one would be a miut, acha miut, and you see, you'd say that includes Yisrael. The third one then would be again needed Legufoi, because when now that you have a miut, acha miut, to include a Yisrael, so then when you have a Kohen, what else is it including? It must be to again limit and say that you need a Kohen, and you're going to go back and forth about like that between one Kohen and one Yisrael. So by the time you reach the 10th one, you're going to have 10, you're going to have five Kohenim and five Yisraelim. So the Gemara says Kasha. So again, it's a Kasha why it would be that way. Why indeed the Mishnah is saying that you can have nine Yisraelim and one Kohen. Why indeed you shouldn't need all 10 of them to be Kohenim. So yeah, it's a good question. But again, nevertheless, that's how it is. Next. The Mishnah had said, "V'odam kayotz v'hen." The Mishnah had continued and said, "A person is like that also." So, what does that mean? The question of "odam mi kodesh." How could a person be? How could a person have? How could a person be belong to hekdesh such that we should talk about? That we're saying that "odam kayotz" means that a person is like karka. You also need nine yisraelim and one koyin to figure out his value. The question is, how does that happen in the first place? A person can't donate himself or another person to hekdesh. Tosfos points out that actually you could be makdish a you could be makdish an eved kanani to hekdish, but nevertheless the Gemara is not assuming the Gemara is not assuming that it's that because first of all because the word odom doesn't necessarily imply an eved, and also because there's an opinion of Rav in Gemara and Gittin that says if a person is makdish a slave he goes free, so therefore the Gemara is not assuming that we're talking about over here. The Yad Ramah says similarly, since it says Odom rather than Eved, so we have to be talking about a Ben Chorin. So what does that mean? What's the scenario? Rabbahu says this goes back to that matter of Erchin versus Domim that we were talking about before. Person says, Domai Alai, I pledge my Domim to the Beis Hamikdash, so we have to figure out how much he's worth were he to be sold as a slave. D'Tanya, as we learn in a Braisa, that if a person says Domai Alai, then we evaluate how much he would be worth as though he were a slave being sold in the market, and that's the amount, and that's the amount he has to pay. So he needs to. So we need to figure out how much. So we need to figure out how much he's worth. The eved itkash lakakos. We find all over the place where an eved there's a hekesh between eved between an eved and karka, namely that exactly that that you that you, you you we find many examples the way you koina an eved. And the way your koina and the way your koina karka are similar, they're both kesef v'shtar v'chazaka. There's a variety of things in which in there's a variety of areas in which avodim are compared to karka. So here also once we're saying that so here also once we're saying that that you need to. That you need to have nine people for that you need to have nine people for 10 people for karka, nine Yisraelim and one Kohen. So the same would be true when we need to figure out the value of a person insofar as Hekdesh is concerned, insofar as Domim is concerned. The Gemara says, "Boy, Rab Ovin." So now Rab Ovin has a question in this connection. Seir ha'omid li gozos b'kama. What would happen? A person A person had said, for example, that he's going to give his domim to Hekdesh, and now he has hair which is ready to be cut. So, Bakama, how many people do we need to evaluate the value of that hair? Or we could have just where he's being Makdish, the hair by itself. That seems to be more the way where we're talking about he's Makdish the hair by himself, by itself. So how many do we need? Kigozu's Domi over Shlosha, would we consider that hair as if it was already, and the hair can be used, Rashi points out, it can be used for a variety of things. So you can use it, for example, to make sieves or various kinds of belts or things like that. Nowadays, you would say you could use it for wigs or whatever. So how many people do you need? So a person that donated to Hektish hair that's attached to the head, then how many people do you need in order to evaluate it? The question is, is that hair considered as though it was already detached from the body over shloisha, and therefore it's enough to have three people, or is it considered like it's still attached to vasara, and therefore you would need 10 because then we would consider it like something that's attached to the eved, and an eved again we said is compared to karka. So Rashi is explaining basically the question is whether we're considering it like the Eved or not. So the Gemara says uvasara, and then you would need 10. So Toshma hamakdishas avdei ein molin bo. Let's learn from a brisa that says that if a person is makdish his slave, then me'ila doesn't apply to it. Because an Eved is like karka, and me'ila does not apply to karka. So Tosfos discusses there are places where we learned, for example, in Bava Basra, there are places where it mentions that Me'ila could conceivably apply to Karka, but that would mean actually where the person took something out of the Karka itself. There's Karka that belongs to Hektish, for example, and he does a pit that belongs to Hektish, and he took a clod of dirt out of the pit. But just to use the pit or the Karka or whatever would not be considered Me'ila. So the same thing over here, then Me'ila wouldn't apply to an Eved. Reb Shimon Gamliel and Molin Besare, Reb Shimon Gamliel says Me'ila would apply to his hair. V'kaimelon Besare Omid L'gozes Pligi. Now we know that Machloikas actually refers to whether if his hair is going to be, his hair is ready to be cut. So therefore, so he's it's already long enough that it's ready to be cut. So Reb Shimon Gamliel is going to consider it as though it was already cut. So Rashi explains, in other words, basically that in effect it's attached to the karka, and therefore and then there was so sort of Shimon Gamliel would say therefore that Me'ila would apply to so sort of Shimon Gamliel would say it's considered as though it's already cut, and the Chum would say it's considered as though it's attached to the karka. So when it comes to Hektish, we would say that you need 10 to evaluate it, but we would also therefore say that Me'ila doesn't apply to it. Rabbeinu Hanano gives an explanation instead that Reb Shimon Gamliel is basically saying that it's a question what was included when the when he was Makdish the Eved in the first place. He explains that Tanakhama would say that when he was Makdish the Eved already with long hair, then he wasn't Makdish the hair in the first place. And Reb Shimon Gamliel would say that the hair is just because it's still attached, then he would say that it automatically goes together with the Hekdish as well. So there is actually in Rabbeinu Hananel there's a footnote over here. Even if kigufay dummy, but even in gufay there's no me'ila because we just said there's no me'ila in a slave. So why, according to Reb Shimon Gamliel, would me'ila apply to the hair if it doesn't apply to the body? So there's a discussion. There's an interesting point from Menachem Zemba, was a famous goyim in Poland before the war. He was killed in the Holocaust, Shemin Pindamoy. So he discusses that so he discusses the what that he explains that what that according to Rabbeinu Hananel, the question would be after the hair was already cut off. So then, according to the Tanakhama, it never became hektish in the first place. So there's no me'ila, and according to Reb Shimon Gamliel, it did become hektish, and therefore me'ila would apply to it. So the point is that the point is we see that there's machloikas whether the hair that's attached is considered to be part of the body or not. So therefore, that will affect the question over here again when he says that when he's makdish the hair alone, do we need 3 or 10 to evaluate it? 3 like metalpalin or 10 like karka? Then it's going to depend on that machloikas, Reb Shimon Gamliel and the Chachamim. Well, the Gemara says, "Name a hani tanoi to hani tanoi." Should we have to say then that that machloikus of Reb Shimon Gamliel on the Chachamim is the same as the machloik as another machloikus tanoim? The Tanan, Reb Meir Oima, yesh dvarim shein kakarka ve'enin kakarka. Reb Meir points out that sometimes you have things which are like karka, but nevertheless, which are like karka, but nevertheless they're not like karka. They're still attached to the ground, but they're still considered to be metaltlin. The in chachamim moedim lo, and the chachamim do not agree with him, and they hold that they're considered completely like anything attached to the ground, and therefore they're bottled to the ground. Ketzad, what does Reb Meir mean by that? He says, "Esther gufanim to unus masarti lacha." What happens? Reuven says to Shimon, "I gave you 10 grapevines laden with fruit that I wanted you to watch for me." Meaning, in other words, I appointed you a shomer over my grapevines, and they were ready. When I gave them to you to watch, the grapes were already ready to be harvested. And Shimon says it wasn't 10 grapevines, it was 5. Now, if this had been metaltlin, that would be a classic example of moedim miktas, and therefore you'd have to take a shua. What happens over here when we're talking about ground, and there's no shvua with moedim miktas when it comes to claims involving land? So does he have to swear or not? Reb Meir Machayev. Reb Meir makes him swear because Reb Meir holds that at this point it's considered a moedim miktas and it's not considered karka because they're ready to, as the Gemara is going to explain in a second, it's ready to be harvested. The Chum say whatever's attached to the ground is considered part of the ground. The Omer Reb Yosef Bachanin about Novim Ha'umdisli Botzer Askinan. We're talking about grapes that are already ready to be harvested. They don't really need to stay on the grapevines anymore. So Mar Sova Kipsuras Damin or Mar Sova Lav Kipsuras Damin. So then Reb Shimon Gamliel is going to hold, rather Reb Meir is going to hold that they're considered as though they're already harvested, and therefore modim miktas would apply to it. And the chum hold they're not; they're considered still like karka, and therefore modim and a shvur modim miktas doesn't apply to karka. So now, should we say then that Reb Shimon Gamliel and the Chachamim, when they were arguing about the hair that's attached, should we say that it's the same machloikas? And the Gemara says, "Loi, afilu tamei Reb Meir." No, you could say that when we said before that the Chachamim say that the Me'ilah does not apply to the hair of the Eved. So you could say that even Reb Meir would agree with that. Ad kan le'kamar Reb Meir hosim. You know why Reb Meir says in the case of the grapes that they're not considered attached to the ground anymore is the kol kamar de'shavka lahu. The longer you leave them on the grapevine, mikhash kachshi, they're going to get ruined. Eventually, you leave them on the grapevines long enough, they're not going to become any better. They're going to eventually they're going to start deteriorating on the vine. There comes a point you have to harvest them. Abel Sire, but when it comes to the hair, kol kama the shavka lahu, the more you leave it on the head, ashbuchi mashbach, it improves, it becomes longer and longer, and it's more and more useful for the various purposes that you can use hair for, and therefore even the mayor might agree that it's still considered like karka, or like the eved, which is compared to karka, as long as it's attached to the head. Okay. So fine. In any case, though, the point is we do have at least the machlokas of Shimon Gamliel and Chachamim regarding the hair, and therefore, so whether if the person is makdish the hair, then it's going to be subject to that machlokas. According to Rashi, again, the point is whether because the hair is attached to the eved, therefore it's considered like the eved, which is karka. According to Rabbeinu Hananel, the question is was he makdish the hair in the first place? Okay. So that ends all of the ones in the Mishnah where we said that you need 3 people to judge something. Now we finally, get to the cases in the Mishnah where we say that you need 23 dayanim. So the Mishnah had said dinin nefashos chola, that dinin nefashos require 23. And one of the ones we mention is Horeveya v'hanirba, whether when there's bestiality involved. The Mishnah had said Horeveya v'hanirba be'estru m'shloisha, that whether the person was the giver or the recipient of the bestiality. Either way, you need 23 to judge them. So the Gemara says, Kaposik v'tani. Well, then the Mishnah is saying, as a blanket statement, Loshna Revea Zacha, Veloshna Revea Nekeva. When we have, when the animal is Revea, when the animal is, it's a male animal, and it's doing Revea to a person, conceivably the person could be a man or a woman. And the Mishnah is saying, as a blanket statement, that either way, that either way, there's going to be skilla involved, and that you're going to need 23 to judge that case. So bishlemed revei nekeva. So now I can understand where we get that when it comes to a woman who was the subject of revia. Dichtiv, the pasuk says v'haragta isha v'asa behema. The pasuk says that when there was bestiality, you should kill the woman and the animal. So therefore, and it's clear, therefore, that you need. And we have a hekesh over there between the woman and the man and the animal. And since as the Mishnah had told us, and we're gonna revisit it in the Gemara later on a couple of dafim, that we need 23 for dinin nefashos of the person. So therefore, we also need 23 for the shor as well. Ella revea zochar menalon. But if it was a male animal committing bestiality with a male person, so the male person was the receiver of it. How do we know that you need menalon? How do we know that you need 23 to judge that case? So the answer is dichtiv, because the pasuk says kol sheichev behema mos yumos. The pasuk says anybody who lies with an animal is put to death. That's referring to a revea zacher. That's referring to the way the person is the active partner and the animal is the recipient. Now im ein inyan l'sheichev. Now we don't really need that pasuk to tell us about a man who commits bestiality who is the active partner with an animal, because we have other pesukim that mention the same point. Tneu inyan l'nishkav. Therefore, instead we have, as the usual rule in Gemara, when we have a pasuk that refers to one thing, we can instead reuse it to refer to something slightly related but different. So then we would refer it instead to the nishkav where the man is being used by the animal. And v'apki rachmana b'loshin sheichev. Now in that case, why doesn't the pasuk just say flat out kol nishkav and behema? Why use the word sheichev then, if in fact we're referring to he's the nishkav, he's the one that the animal is, he's the one where the animal is doing it, and he's the recipient. The reason is, la kushi nishkav l'sheichev. The reason would be in order to make a hekesh between those two cases. Just like when the man is the one committing bestiality with the animal, then we would need 23. And we know that again because the pasuk says that when a man commits bestiality with an animal and he's the one who's doing it to the animal, then he and the animal both get skila. And again, the Hekesh tells us that just like he needs 23, so does the animal. Af nishkav huv empty, v'esim v'shloisha, the same thing. We're going to say when it comes to the nishkav, because the pasuk is speaking of the nishkav in Parashas Mishpatim with the pasuk called sheichev v'mehema mois yumas, but using the word sheichev rather than nishkav, then that tells us that the same dinim apply, whether sheichev or nishkav. Either way, we need 23 to judge the person and 23 to judge the animal. Okay. Next. The Gemara continues. Shara nisko v'estru m'shloisha. The Mishnah had said another example where an animal needs to be judged and based in is a shur that needs skila, for example, because it killed somebody. So then also, and the reason is because as the pasuk says, asher yisok of a gamba all of yomos, as the pasuk says, the shur should be given skila, and also the owner should be put to death. Now we're going to explain in a second, the owner of a shur that killed somebody is not actually put to death. Here we're talking even a shur muad, even the animal has done it three times, which is what this pasuk is talking about. The owner is not actually put to death. Instead, he needs to pay a koifer. But nevertheless, you have that expression that puts them together. Kemisas abaylam, kach misas asher. So we learn from that the same way as the owner would be executed by a basin of 23, the same way the shur requires a basin of 23. Omale Abaya l'Rava. So Abaya asks Rava, where b'chlal are we getting that it doesn't mean to put the owner to death? Mimai dehai v'gamba all of yumos lich misas abaylam kach misas asher hudasa. How do we know that in fact that pasuk is telling us to is being used for that hekesh? Emalak tola hudasa. Maybe indeed it's being used to tell us that the owner of the animal himself is being executed. So how are we going against the complete pshat of the pasuk? The simple pshat is v'gamba all of yomos, the owner is indeed put to death. So how can we go against that pshat? Amalei, so Rava answers him, Kane, if that were the case, that the owner is actually Chayav Misa as well, then if we were to say that, Lichtiv Gamba Olav Velishtik, then the Pasuk could have just said, the Pasuk could have said, Asher Yisak over Gamba Olav. The owner is given Skila and also its owner. And therefore, when and then we would understand just that, that it means that that both of them are getting Skila. So therefore, so since it says instead, since it says that extra word yumos, then we understand that it means something else. It means to make the hekesh, and it means to say that that the owner is not actually put to death, but rather that there's a comparison between him and the shur. Tosfos also discusses maybe it means misa b'dei shamayim, maybe but then still so it could say yumos when it says yumos implies by beis din. Anyway, so the Gemara says, what do you mean, b'skila sakadaydach? What do you mean that the owner conceivably would get skila? Kotel iu b'sayif mamoni b'skila. What would be the logic? If the person himself were to kill, then he would be chayev hereg. Out of the four misses based, and so we're going to have, as the Gemara is going to explain in a second, you have different opinions about what the order of the dalad misses based is in terms of how severe they are. But skila is definitely higher than hereg. And if he himself kills, he's going to get hereg. He's going to be executed by being by having his head chopped off. So what's the logic? Kotel ihu b'sayif. If he himself had killed, he would be getting sayif, which is the third or fourth of the misses based in. Kotel shoda b'skila. What's the lot? Mamona b'skila. What's the logic that if his mamon, that if his shor, which belongs to him, had killed, that instead he would get skila, which is a much higher punishment? So therefore it's not logical to say that he would get skila in the first place. So why would we think that he would get why would we think that he get so why would we think, even if the Pasuk hadn't said Yumas, that he should get skila? Well, the Gemara says Viduma hai de kosa rahmana yumas la kuli ale. So maybe you could say fakert, the word yumas is coming to be makel on him. La puki misayef lachenek. Maybe the word is fakert. In general in the Torah, we say that whenever it says yumas without specifying what the punishment is, then it means that he's getting chenek. So maybe the Pasuk is saying over here that instead of having, maybe we would say he is being put to death because his animal killed, but instead of it being hereg, instead we're going to downgrade him to chenek, and maybe the word yumos is coming to tell us that. The Gemara says, "Hanichal mando am a chenek chomer." Well, that would work very nicely according to the opinion of Reb Shimon later on in the Masechta, who says that chenek is higher in the list than hereg. We usually say the list skila sefer hereg and chenek, and that's actually in the order of their severity. Skila is considered the harshest, then sefer, then hereg, then chenek. Reb Shimon, though, holds the other way around. Reb Shimon holds that chenek is less. Reb Shimon holds that chenek is more severe than hereg. Later on in the Masechta, we're going to discuss in detail why they hold their respective opinions. So, if you say that chenek is if you're going to say that you're going to say that, on the other hand, that the pasuk is not telling us that the owner is put to death at all, and that the words yumas in the pasuk is only there for a hekesh, well then you would say hanichal amanda am a chenek chomer. Well, that would work well according to the opinion that chenek is more serious, is more severe, and then you would say therefore, so the Torah is telling us that he's not going to get that severe punishment of chenek. And instead it means it's there only for the Durasha. But if you say that chenek is less severe than hereg, maybe you should say the Pasuk is telling us if he himself had killed, he would get hereg, which is more severe, because instead it was his shor that killed, then we'll give him a break, and instead he'll get chenek, which is less severe. But maybe it still means that he's being put to death. And the answer is lois sakadaitach. You can't think that way, that he's going to get that he's going to get that he, that he should get executed at all. Dichtiv, because after all, the pasuk continues im koifer yushas olav. The pasuk continues if a ransom is imposed on him, then he pays that ransom. The sakadaitach baktolahu. If you're going to say that he would have been deserving the death penalty, well, then you have a pasuk elsewhere at the end of parashas at the end of Parshas Maaseh, that says, "Don't take a koifer, don't take a ransom for the life of a ritzeach. Instead, you have to execute him." So, if the pasuk is saying over here that you do, if the pasuk over here is saying that you do take a koifer over here for him, then that itself means that he's not chayav misa in the first place. Well, the Gemara says, "Adrabba, mishum hi gufa." Well, that isn't that the very point? Kotel ihu leitiskele b'mamayna. You would say if he himself killed, it's not going to be enough for him to pay money. Ela biktola. Rather you have to execute him. Kotel shorei. But you could say that maybe the pasuk is implying that if his shor killed lifrik nafshim b'mamayna, then he needs to ransom himself with money. So maybe in fact the pasuk with Vegamba all of Yomas, maybe indeed the pasuk is saying the owner is chayev misa. However, if he pays a kofer, then he can get out of it. Had it been that he himself, rather than his shur, killed, we wouldn't even give him that break, and we would say altogether that he's chayev misa regardless, and he can't even pay for it. And the Meshech Chochma makes a point that maybe we would say, okay, what are you going to say that? And if the guy can't afford the kofar, is basically going to execute him. What's the logic of that? So he says maybe it means the goyel adam would be able to get him. Anyway, the point is, how do we know that it doesn't mean any of that, and that the Vgalim Ba'ol of Yomas never means in the first place that the owner is Chayav Misa, but only that he has to pay, and we use it only to teach us this Hekesh of K'misas Abaylam, Kach Misas Asher? How do we know? Elo Omer Chizkiah, so rather, Chizkiah explains, V'chein Tona Dvei Chizkiah, and we learn similarly in a Braisa from the Yeshiva of Chizkiah, so in other words, Chizkiah didn't just teach this as an Amora. He also composed a brisa that says the same thing. That he says when the omakra, the pasuk says most yumas hamaka retzeachu. The pasuk says again there in Parashas Mishpatim when you're talking about a retzeach having to be killed, it says the one who killed has to be executed because he's a retzeach. So we learn from that. What's those extra words? Retzeachu, aretzichose atahergoy. You execute him for killing, for his own killing. V'atahergoy aretzichas shorei. You don't execute him for his shor killing somebody. So ultimately, that's where we learn from. Therefore, that there's no killing, there's no execution of the owner of the shor for his shor killing, and therefore, and only when the shor was a mord, then he pays a koifer. So now, when it says v'gamba all of yomas, then we can use it for that drasha about k'misas abaylam kach misas asher, that just as if it were to be a case where he's chayav misa, where he's being tried for a chiyuv misa, and he needs to be tried by a beis din of 23, so it is also with the shor that it needs to be tried by a beis din of 23. So now the Gemara goes into a related point. You know, all this time we're talking about a shor and niskal. Now, in the Torah we have in halacha for all times we have two ways in which a shor, in two circumstances in which a shor would be killed. One is where there was bestiality involved that we talked about before, and the other one would be when the shor killed somebody, as we were just discussing now. But now you have another. You have in history. You have one other example where a shur is being killed, namely by Har Sinai. The pasuk tells us that the pasuk tells us as long as the Shechina is on Har Sinai by Matan Torah and for a period of time after it. So the pasuk says Lo Siga Bo Yod. Nobody is allowed to touch or come close to Har Sinai, except for Moshe and Aaron and the other ones who are supposed to go up there. And the pasuk says in Behemim Ish Lo Yichya, whether man or animal. Then it's not going to live, it's going to be killed. So now, so the Gemara asks, suppose that a shur went up to the mountain by Har Sinai, and it had to be judged, and executed, because when the pasuk says the shur or the person is going to be killed, we don't mean that just they're going to die on the spot. We mean that they have to be brought to Beis Din and they have to be judged, and there has to have been Edim v'hasra and the whole business. So how many dayanim would have been needed for that? Tosfos explains the question is not so much about a person. The question is not so much about a person who went up there, because then it's obvious that you would need 23. Because Tosfos points out Yisrael had already come along and told and then suggested to Moshe about setting up Sanhedrins, so they had already the concept of Sanhedrin Ketana at that point, and therefore it's obvious that we would need three people to judge that kind of case. But the question is about the animal, where maybe when they'd set up Bote Dinim, they hadn't yet set them up for animals necessarily. That's only after the Torah was given, and here we're talking about before the Torah is given. Different Mephoshim talk about the fact is it's not so simple that Yisro's advice to appoint judges was before Matan Torah anyway. There's the whole Machlokas in Sanhedrin. Rashi mentions that on the Pesukim in Parashas Yisro, whether B'chlal the whether Yisra had come before Matan Torah or after it. And if you say that this is after, and if you say this is after Matan Torah, then not necessarily, then not necessarily are there Dayanim yet. But so sort of Rabbi Yaakov Emden discusses that point, and he points out that after all, the Shekhinah didn't just leave Haus Sinai until right after Matan Torah. It stayed there until it stayed there actually until they left Haus Sinai, which was even after the Mishkan had been set up. So therefore, so you do have, so even according to the opinion that Yisrael came later, you still have plenty of time for there to be Dayanim you still have plenty of time for there to be Dayanim to be judging people who went up to Har Sinai. So now the question is, would the same rule apply as far as animals? Tosfos also wonders about my dehava hava. What's done is done. It's some. It's a one-time thing in history. There's never again going to be a Matan Torah. So therefore, so what do we, what is it, what does it matter? So Tosfos says we need it to understand the psukim. Just we want to understand the psukim. We want to understand that point. How many people would be needed for that purpose? Different other mafarshim point out different possibilities why we need it. And the Yad Ramah in fact explains in a little more detail. Look, the pasuk tells us he's chayiv misa. So we want to know. We want to understand then how that misa would work. How many people would actually be needed in order to judge him. Various other there are different other mafoshim who point out about it. One interesting point the Meiri brings from a mechilta that from a Yerushalmi rather that the din would apply not only to Haus Sinai but also to the Mishkan and the Beis Hamikdash. If an animal wanders in there, then it also is chayav misa, and they not obviously not if you bring it as a korban, but if an animal stam wanders in there, and therefore the question would be how many people you need to in order to judge it. And then there's further explanations about that. Why, how would that be? Even a person is only chayav misa b'dei shemayim, only if he goes into the Kodesh HaKadoshim. So an interesting point is maybe when the animal is still there inside the Beis Hamikdash, then maybe at that point it would be chayiv skila. Anyway, different mafarshim talk about different other possibilities. What the nafkamina of it would be, where one as you often have a nafkamina can be in connection with nedarim. For example, you can have let's say a person makes a neder. I'm gonna give to tzedakah a certain amount of money, about as much as the number of dayanim who are needed to judge an animal that had gone up to Har Sinai. So then we need to know how many people that is. Anyway, whatever the case, that's the question. The question is mi gomer shah mi doros oloi. Do we learn something that happened as a one-time thing by Matan Torah? Do we learn from that to future generations or the other way around? Do we learn from future generations to then? Just like in future generations, an animal is going to be judged needs 23, so now also needs 23 oloi. Or do we not say that? So the Gemara says Toshma, the Tani Rami by Yecheskel. Well, we can prove because Rami by Yecheskel says Im behemayim ish lo yichya. The pasuk says whether man or animal, it will not live; it's going to be killed. So we have a hekesh ma ish b'chav gimel af behema b'chav gimel. Just like a person would require 23 to judge him, and that we know, as Tosfos says, they already had the concept of Sanhedrin at that point. So the same way an animal is going to require 23. So yes, so it's going to require. So the answer is yes. If an animal had gone up to Haus Sinai, then you would need 23 in order to. You would need 23 to judge it. Okay. Fine. The Mishnah continues. Ha'ariva hazev. Although the Mishnah mentions other cases where we need a base kin of 23 is not just when it comes to a shur who kills a person, but also the Mishnah mentions a number of different wild animals: a wolf, a lion, a bear, a leopard, or a bardless or a snake. Now Rashi defines that a bardless, he gives a French translation for it, putius, which is a polecat. It's a little polecat. It's a little animal similar to a weasel or a skunk. Tosfos wonders about that. Such animals are not so vicious as to kill people. So Tosfos discusses some other possibilities that a bardless would actually be some kind of dangerous snake. There are other possibilities as well, and then a bardless can also mean like a leopard or something, whatever the point, or a hyena, whatever the point is, that it says these are all dangerous animals. So the Mishnah had said that you need a Beis Din of 23 to judge them and execute them. So the Shlokish says that would only be if such animals actually killed someone. If they didn't kill anybody, then no, you don't just say they're automatically dangerous animals and anybody who sees them and kills them is a good thing. No, you have to wait until you have to see if they actually kill anybody. Otherwise, we assume that they can be tamed. Alma Kasava. Yeshlahem. So we see that Rish Lakish holds that. So what it is in Mishnah when we mention these five, when we mention these six animals, Rabbi Eliezer Oymer Kolak Koydim Lahogan Zocha. Rabbi Eliezer says whoever finds them and kills them first is Zoicha. He did a good thing by removing a danger. But Rish Lakish is saying even Rabbi Eliezer is talking about only when they actually killed already. So Rabbi Eliezer would say another. So in other words, the Tanakhama had said that you need 23. Rabbi Eliezer is saying, Kol HaKodim LaHogan Zocha. He's saying you don't need 23, but you could kill them right on the spot. But the fact is, they need to have killed first. You can't stam say you see somebody's pet lion, you can automatically kill it. Rabbi Shlokish is saying that's not what Rabbi Eliezer means. So Alma Kasava, Yeshlahen Tarbus, meaning we see from that Shlokish holds that it is possible to that it is possible to tame a lion or any of these other creatures. So therefore, so it's not considered hefker. So if they killed, then fine, you can kill them. But otherwise, it's not considered hefker. And so the only machlokes would be once they killed, do you need a Beis Din of 23 to try them and have them executed, or can anybody do it? But Rish Lakish is saying it needs to be they do have an owner, and you can't stam willy-nilly kill them. That's according to Rish Lakish. So Alma Kasava, Yeshlahen Tarbus, V'Yeshlahen Bailim. So we see, therefore, that he holds that it is possible to tame them, and it is considered somebody has a valid ownership of them, and you can't stam kill them. Rabbi Yochanan, I'm a Misu. Rabbi Yochanan, though, understands Rabbi Eliezer to be saying that you can that they can be killed on sight even if they haven't killed anybody. So in other words, according to Rabbi Yochanan, the flow of the Mishnah would be the Tanakhama is saying you need 23 to judge it when they killed, and Rabbi Eliezer is saying not only if they killed do you not need 23, but even if they didn't kill, you need 23. Just the fact that somebody has a lion is reason enough to kill it. Alma Kasava Ein Lahem Tarbus Ein Lahem Bailim, which shows, therefore, that Rabbi Yochanan holds they can't be tamed. They're not considered to have an owner, so they're considered like hefker because the owner shouldn't have been raising it in the first place. So therefore, so according to Rabbi Yezer, then in our Mishnah you could kill them on the spot. Okay, the Gemara says Tanan, Rabbi Eliezer Oymer Kol HaKodim LaHogan Zocha. Well, let's look again at the Mishnah. In the Mishnah, Rabbi Eliezer had said that whoever kills them first is Zoicha. B'shleimel Rabbi Yechanan. Now, according to Rabbi Yechanan, it's easy to understand what he means by Zoicha. Zoicha implies that he gains something from it. It doesn't just mean that he's Zoicha as in like he did a mitzvah. It means he's Zoicha in something tangible. So, b'shleimel Rabbi Yechanan, l'may zocha zocha la'oran. So, according to Rabbi Yechanan, you can say that when Rabbi Eliezer says kol hakodim lahogan, he's zoicha, then it means he gets to keep the skin. Since the animal is considered hefker, then therefore, when he kills it, the meat he may not have much to do with, but at least the skin he could keep for himself and use it for some useful purpose. Ela l'Rish Lakish, but according to Rish Lakish, the animal did have an owner. Fine, he wasn't. Now that it turned out to be dangerous, then we have to kill it. And Rabbi Eliezer is saying you can kill it on the spot and not wait for the Beis Din of 23 to try it. But nevertheless, the fact is it has an owner. Why wouldn't we return the skin to the owner? Why would we say that the whoever killed the animal is Zoiche? So the answer is kiven shehimitzah, because since he killed it, shavinu rabbanan commanded gomer dinayu, the chachamim are treating it as though the Beis Din had actually been judged by a as though the animal had actually been judged by a Beis Din of 23. Because again, according to Rabbi Eliezer, you're saying that you don't need to judge it with a Beis Din of 23. It's enough that anybody can see it and kill it. So it's considered as though nigmar adin v'isturei hana ninu. At that point, it's considered an isur hana. The fact is, for example, with a shor aniskol, if a shor kills somebody, then the din is once Beis Din has issued the verdict and the animal is chayiv misa, then it becomes also b'hana. Well, the same thing over here. We're going to say that this lion or bear or what have you, the same thing. Once a person unilaterally, according to Rabbi Eliezer, which he can do, judge that it needs to be killed because, according to Rish Lakish, it already killed somebody, and now he's gonna take the matter into his own hands and actually kill the animal. Then fine, at that point it becomes also bana. Well, then the skin is also for the is also to the owner. So therefore he can keep it. So my zocha zocha l'shamayim. So therefore, necessarily you have to say that you write the word zocha What does he mean? He's zoicha to Hashem. In other words, that he has a schus in Hashem's eyes that he removed a dangerous thing. But nevertheless, we would still say that that's what it means. So it doesn't. It wouldn't mean therefore that. So in other words, in other words, according to the according to Rabbi Yochanan and Rish Lakish, so it's like this. In other words, again, according to Rish Lakish, what it is like this. The Tanakhama says that the animal always has to be judged by 23. Rabbi Eliezer would be saying that it, that when it, that, so and obviously you're judging it with 23 only when it killed, according to the Chachamim. Rabbi Eliezer would say, according to Rish Lakish, that if it killed, you don't need 23. Anybody can kill it, and Zocha would have to mean Zocha L'Shamayim. It's also Bahana, but he did a mitzvah by doing that. According to Rabbi Yochanan, the flow of the Mishnah is the Chachamim are saying you need 23 if it killed. Rabbi Yezu, and according to Rish Lakish, if the animal hadn't killed, if the bear or the lion or whatever hadn't killed, then you can't kill it at all. It has an owner, and you can't do anything with it. According to Rish Lakish, according to Rabbi Yochanan, the flow of it is the Tanakhama is saying these animals killed, you need 23. Rabbi Eliezer would say that even if these animals didn't kill, just the fact that you see that there's a bear or a lion or a wolf or whatever, go ahead and kill it. And Zocha, and Yanyu Zocha, to keep the skin. Tosfos points out there's a case in Bava Kamma that mentions a cat that's dangerous, where you kill it, and there you can keep the skin. There everybody would agree you can keep the skin, but pastures because even Rabbi Yochanan would agree it's legitimate to keep a cat as a pet in the first place, but not a bear or a wolf or a lion or the rest of them. And when the Mishnah had continued, Rabbi Akiva had said that Misosin v'Esther Mishloisha. So the question is, Rabbi Akiva, Hainu Tanakama, isn't he saying the same thing as the Tanakama, who also said you need 23? And the answer is Ikabanau Nochosh. The argument between the Tanakama and Rabbi Akiva would be as far as the snake. You have six animals mentioned in the Mishnah, and the Tanakhama would say a snake is the sixth one, and he also needs 23 in order to judge it and kill it. Rabbi Akiva would say a snake is an exception. You don't need, he would say that nochosh mu'ud la'olam, he says a nochosh is always considered dangerous, and therefore you would have to, and therefore, Rabbi Akiva would say you kill it regardless, and you don't wait until it kills. But the other one, he would say that you have to wait until and that he would say that you don't need 23 to judge it. You can just kill it on the spot, as opposed to the other ones. That oh, you know what? I skipped a few lines in the Gemara. Tanya kavaseid Rish Lakish echad shor shehemis. Whether a shor killed v'echad behema v'chayah shehemisu, or whether a domestic or wild animal killed b'chof gimel, you need 23. Rabbi Eliezer a shor shehemis be'esim reshloisha. Rabbi Eliezer says a shor that killed requires 23, or shar behema v'chayah shehemisu, whereas any other animal, domestic or wild, that killed kol akodim lahogan zocha behem l'shamayim. Whoever kills him first is zoicha to a Hashem, he did a mitzvah, so that Bryce agrees exactly with Rish Lakish's understanding of what Rabbi Eliezer means. With that said, though, the halacha is like the Chachamim, that they always need to be judged by 23. Okay, and then we said Rabbi Akiva Oymachul, Rabbi Akiva Hanatanakama, Ikabanao Nochosh, that Rabbi Akiva would hold that a Nochosh is an exception. You don't need 23 to kill it. There, anybody can do it, as opposed to the other animals, you need a base din of 23. Worth mentioning in this connection, by the way, before we end. So here we're saying that a lion can never fully be tamed. Rabbi Yochanan is saying that lions and other such wild animals like that are not bnei taubos. You can never really fully tame them. Even you think they were tamed, and all of a sudden they show their true nature, and they show that they're after all a wild animal. Some years ago there was an example of that with a famous thing that made headlines, where a guy was attacked by pet tiger. But anyway, there's a the Rebbe makes an interesting point from that in a sicha. We have Bilam compares the Jewish people to a crouching lion, and so the Rebbe explains in the sicha the point of it is the same way as a lion, we're saying, it may live for years and years as a seemingly tame animal, but then one day it goes and kills somebody, and we're saying that that shows that all along it wasn't ben taubos, it never really had been fully domesticated. The same way a yid, he may be living for years and years, not even acting in the slightest way like a yid, but all of a sudden the chips are down, and something all of a sudden out of the blue, a yid shows that he really has that power of a lion, and he really shows that he shows his true nature as a yid. That's the connection. That's the comparison of a yid to a lion. That no matter what, even you think for years and years he's been tamed and domesticated and acting like any other person in the world, like any goy, but all of a sudden you discover it's not so, and he has the power of a yid within him.
Yeah.